I'll start by introducing Diane Myrmegas. I'd like to point all of you to an article that's in your packet that she wrote with us about business models for the interactive, consumer-centric public media era. Diane is an award-winning business journalist and columnist. Diane, here's your order. Specializing in media, entertainment, telecommunications, and the Internet, as well as the economics, trends, and issues that drive them. She has served as a consultant to such firms as PricewaterhouseCoopers and a number of venture capital groups on digital media trends and strategies. As editor-at-large at MediaPost, she writes the Daily On Media column. And thanks. She's going to be leading the conversation today. Our other panelists include Craig Riegel, partner at the NFF Capital Partners, serving clients on the West Coast. NFF has been working with some media projects, I think, in the room, thinking about ways to strengthen nonprofit media business models. He joined NFF in 2007 after serving as a project-based consultant to the Capital Partners business for over a year, which I think you'll hear more about. He comes to NFF with a long history of solving the dilemmas of growth in diverse environments. Vincent Staley is the program director for nonprofit sector support at the Cerdna Foundation, a family foundation based in New York City with more than $900 million in assets. He's the chair of the board of directors of the New York Regional Association of Grantmakers and also serves on the board of directors at Volunteer Match, Youth Noise, and Grantmakers in Film and Electronic Media. Before that, he was one of us. He was a journalist, wrote for the Chronicle of Philanthropy and other publications. And Ernest J. Wilson, the third, is the Walter Annenberg Chair in Communication and Dean of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. He's also a senior fellow at the USC Center on Public Diplomacy and an adjunct fellow at the Pacific Council on International Policy, and he's a CPB board member. So hopefully he'll, from our mouths to their ears. thank you all.
Jessica?
Oh, I miss Keith. Keith was...
Am I on the right panel?
Keith was nice enough to come in because Henry wasn't able to join us physically. He leads the software community efforts for Public Interactive. His team's current initiative is Public Action, a platform that enables public broadcasters to build online communities. And there's a flyer in your packets about what they've learned.
Hello. Good afternoon, and thanks for being with us. This is so exciting because I love think tanks. This is like a big think tank. So, I just wanted to start out my comments, having covered, you know, commercial, non-commercial, every kind of media you can think of for the last 20 years. I was doing a lot of thinking in preparation for this on how, you know, the two are different in this digital interactive age that we're in. And I have to tell you, and this is good news, that you have the leg up. And it's the reason is because you've been where new media is all along. You have your roots in the people. You are grassroots oriented. Your stars are perfectly aligned with where the internet is and where the new digital interactive media is taking us. The intimidation factor comes in is how to work with it, how to monetize it, how to get to where you want to be, which is hopefully financially self-sufficient and still true to your principles. And I believe that that can be done. Now, the one thing we all have to accept, I think, in having this conversation is that everyone is in the same place. Public media, public broadcasting is in no different place than commercial broadcasting or any other kind of media right now. You're all faced with the same thing. When I sit down with Rupert Murdoch or any of the other big guys over on the traditional media side, they're full of questions, more questions than answers. But again, you know, if you're willing to redefine some of what you're about, if you're willing to redefine concepts that are clearly tied to traditional static analog media, such as advertising, which will no longer be advertising in the new world, it's connecting with your target consumer, then I think that you can make a go of it, but you have to get from here to there. So the first thing I was going to do was to tell you a little bit about a trip back in time that I took Just as a coincidence, this past weekend, I was cleaning out the attic of our 130-year-old house back in Chicago with the kids, and I ran across a bunch of old analyst reports. And I've always been financially oriented in my reporting. This is called the Blueprint for Media Investment from Merrill Lynch, September 2002. And I found this too late to put it up on a graphic here. But basically, it's got all your little circles, you know, and the circles are according to the size of that media category. And I can tell you it goes from music to radio to games to Europay TV, but there isn't one social network on this map. There isn't a social network, there isn't a blog, there isn't anything, there isn't email, nothing of what we consider to be our new media environment today. And this is September 2002. So sometimes the perspective we need, we get from just stepping back a little bit, realizing how far we've come, realizing that, as the previous speakers have said, we're just turned the first corner. There are many to come. And in fact, one of the most exciting things, and if I get excited, it's because the future is so great. I'm working on a book right now that looks out 5 years and tries to look at the changes in the business models and the economics and all that and the creativity. And one of the things you realize is that none of the institutions, none of the corporations, none of the governments, anywhere in the world, even Apple, even Google, and their children of this new media age, have bored down into their legacy structures, into their infrastructures, to really integrate the interactivity and all that goes with it, so that they can actually think it, breathe it, use it for every aspect of their business. When we get to that point, we will have turned the second of many corners, but that's going to take some time. So again, I think this kind of perspective helps when you're saying, oh my gosh, we've got to embrace all this, we've got to change what we're doing, but we still want to be true to who we are. How do we do this? Well, you have wonderful examples already in public broadcasting and NPR. In fact, you have far more progressive examples there than you have almost anywhere else on the commercial broadcasting side. So for that, you should be proud. But what you need to do is to not only make a commitment, but then follow it up with action. What we're here to talk about today is maybe how do we go about that. And whether it means, and I know this is blasphemous to some of you, but clearly there are minds, progressive minds, willing to try some of these things already. Whether that means taking some of your content, putting it on a major clearinghouse online, such as Public Broadcasting has just done with a couple of shows on Hulu.com, which is a Fox NBC co-enterprise, and they have bookended the shows with 30-second commercials. 30-second commercials, yes, I said 30-second commercials. And they are revenue sharing. Now, the commercials, I think, are kind of going to look historically as commercials have on television, because Hulu.com is from NBC and Fox, and they don't know how to do it any other way. They will figure it out. But say, for instance, you take a sponsorship of one of your programs, okay? And you explain to the sponsor that what you're doing is producing your program of choice, editorial, free-spirited program, take it or leave it. Buy into it, don't buy into it. Somebody will buy into it. And you're connecting with this particular group of consumers. Somebody will want to connect with that target audience, because you can define them so many ways now, right? And so you produce the show that you want. It's editorially, it maintains its integrity. You find sponsors who want to connect with the people who are most likely watch the show, because they're the people who most likely will want their products and services. And that is a wholly capitalistic endeavor, of which you don't need to be at all apologetic. And then the consumer who watches a show that's sponsored by all these different companies decides of their own accord to buy into them or not to buy into them. Yes, I want to begin an interactive rapport with this sponsor because I'm interested. It's my decision. No, I don't. And therein lies the secret to making an advertising type commitment connection on the net, because then you will begin a rapport between a company and consumers they will inevitably, they'll do research, they'll buy into each other, the company will learn from that consumer, they will sell to that consumer. You have e-commerce. You could always go back and say, okay, for every e-commerce transaction that you conduct with any of our constituents, we would like a 10%, you know, fee or something like that. There are many ways. I guess what I'm saying is, the long and short of it is, that's one of many ways that I'm trying to model new business initiatives that you can start to embrace that will generate new revenues for you. And as your 15% funding from the government continues to disappear, and as the sponsors and the foundations who now support you try to find new ways to explore the internet, and as the members that you've relied on, okay, are looking for new ways to redefine their relationships, because it is, after all, consumer-centric, they're deciding, you will grow with them in a way where you're still true to your roots. Some of the other models that I've suggested are in the article that's in your packet. And if you're interested, you could take a look at it. But I think more than anything else, this is a time where you really have to come to this open-minded, because you have everything it takes to succeed. Okay? So our panelists are going to help us to explore this. And I'm told that Keith will go first. I'm following orders. So Keith, take it away.
Cool. Now that I'm on the panel, right on. So I come from the web application space, and I get to play in building applications, and I've been to a bunch of conferences that pretty much invariably there's always a panel on funding and monetization, and I swear this was the last panel I ever thought I'd be on. But there's one thing that's frequently ignored in those panels, and it always sort of drove me nuts. So although I don't have a ton of time, I'm going to spend my 5 minutes talking about it, which is a little regrettable because I'm a huge fan of DIY culture. I've made it through Yochai Benkler's book, and I know. I see Henry Jenkins whenever I can, and I hang out with the Make Magazine guys. So I hope when we get into conversation, I'll have a chance to talk a little bit about that. But what I'm talking about now is not about that. But based on my experience with helping build online community, which is what I do on a day-to-day basis with public broadcasters, and on working in the web, I think the advice I would give anyone with a public media initiative or property and trying to explore monetization is focus on getting more online users. Again, it's something that people are afraid to talk about. It might sound off topic a little bit for funding, but I assure you it's not. Within our emerging web application and online media culture, user interaction, which includes Henry's user participation, is the new currency. And let me give you a couple examples, big and small. So Google invented a fantastic search engine first, and then came up with AdWords. Google and Yahoo give away their content and most of their services for free in order to attract users. This is de rigueur in Web 2.0. Whether you agree with it or not, pretty much universally they build user base, or new applications build a user base first, and then they determine how to monetize it. And if you look at particular pieces of media like web comics and viral videos, these folks who are producing these pieces aren't saying, how am I going to monetize this? How many t-shirts am I going to sell? They want people to look at it, and then they get the MTV spot. So they do this all to get visibility and adoption, and I want to stress that. So what do I mean by user interaction? Not just user registrations, but really online relationship or interaction, product downloads, media sharing, remixing, reusing, references in blogs and social networks. I think the aggregated value of this conference has gone up just in its Twitter tag, for example. The community or discussions that you either find or build around your organization or products. So these are all examples of user interaction. But why is it so important? First off, the network effect that results buys leverage and choice. So by network effect, I mean if you get users and 1% of those users help you get more users, then you grow exponentially, and this buys you a significant amount of leverage with potential partners and underwriters. It also provides you with choice. Another reason is users increasingly have more control around your product visibility, around your brand perception. If you're talking about media, they're actually doing the distribution of it, and eventually they're going to be doing the production and monetization as well. Third, no users, no money. Whether you're selling coffee cups or donations or you're carving out or enclosing some piece of your media, each one of those depends on a user to make the revenue. And lastly, if you were to monetize first and build users second, you run the risk of corrupting your environment. Users have choice. If they want to choose between participating in an environment that controls some aspect of their experience and one that doesn't, they're going to choose the one that gives them more choice, more openness to do what they want. Finally, a brief point that most public media, I would argue, don't have enough user interaction to monetize. The exception here, while there are certainly several, might be podcast downloads, but I will argue that a significant number of podcast downloads happen in iTunes, which is a place that we don't have control over, nor can we necessarily monetize easy. And to end with a real map, if Claire, you could bring up the Alexa slide. First of all, I apologize for using Alexa. The data really does suck, I will admit it, but it's all I had, and it's over here. And what I've briefly shown is I've taken two of our largest media properties. Oh, Alexa measures traffic. On the x-axis is time, y-axis is traffic and reach. And what you'll see is PBS and NPR sites. I picked those not to represent, only to represent a piece of the media industry. They happen to be two of the biggest properties in the way of traffic, and compared them to two regional newspaper websites, which both actually get more traffic. Now, again, this is Alexa, and I also want to point out that PBS just notified me, and they'll be announcing very soon that compared to TV broadcasters, they are the number one TV broadcaster on the web in the way of website traffic. And just a little plug for Boston, which is where I'm from. The green line is the Boston Globe, or Boston.com, and of course it's green, Celtics. That's why it's peaking.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Craig. You are up next.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be here talking to a bunch of people who are in some very tangible way changing the world in which I live and plan to for quite some time. I'm not one of those people who goes out and does that. I don't have great vision about how I'm going to change the world, really. Well, except that I recognize that individuals around me are what make that happen in favorable ways. And so I spend my time with an outfit called the Nonprofit Finance Fund, helping people who have an opportunity to really improve the world in which we live not have the rug pulled out from under them. We spend time focusing on improving the financial health of organizations and providing for and helping them provide for the infrastructure that really cradles the process of delivering these mission-critical programs that we count on. And recently that has been, I've been fortunate enough to be included in doing some work around some of the media organizations in this room who I think are doing phenomenal things. Specifically, we believe that institutions need dollars to persist. I guess I would look around the room and ask all of those of you who are currently spending a significant portion of your time working on public media issues as defined by the FAQs, would you raise your hand, please? Is that everybody? And for all of you that are there that are doing that, affiliated with some organization, for-profit, non-profit, education, government, would you put your hands back up? And for that same audience, for all of you for whom it's important that you are able to provide for yourself and your family as part of doing that, would you raise your hands? Okay. So having institutions that take care of our missions is important. Having money that flows through that is really important. And we think that having transparency and talking clearly about that is a big deal. In this space in particular, I think building institutions that will curate and provide context for information is really important. Otherwise, YouTube would have launched and we would have hung out a big mission accomplished banner. That didn't happen, thankfully. When I think about what it is that enables an institution to support that, The answer, and I love that the definition in the FAQs for public media is not about revenue or tax status. It's not about organizational structure. It's about the mission and what do they hope to accomplish. In order to have an organization that in an enduring way helps this mission, you need to have a business model. And whether that's a commercial business model that needs to go and come up with a dollar and 10 cents or a dollar and a quarter for every dollar they spend, or a nonprofit business model that needs to come up with a buck and a nickel, not a lot of difference. The key issue is that the costs of doing this work, which are very expensive, need to be raised somehow. What's important is to plan that work and understand the financial implications and build a business model that's sustainable. Bringing in revenue needs to be decriminalized. The sense that public media is free is simply wrong. Simply wrong. And I don't care if that decriminalization is about the fundraising activities that go on with foundations or if it's about advertising. Admittedly, I'd be offended if Pfizer was sponsoring factcheck.org. I guess when I think about advertising, there are many ways that can happen, some of which interrupt mission, some of which don't. I don't have any particular preference about which revenue source supports organizations and media. I guess there's good news and bad news. The good news is that the rules in media seem to be changing every few years and really, really rapidly. The bad news is that when I look around today at the organizations where we've had a touch and the organizations I see in the press, there are really only four ways that media companies that I see operating in the internet space in the digital era make money. Only four ways, regardless of what business they're in. The first is they participate in commerce. People want to buy something and they take a slice of that. And that's the biggest way, by the way. The second is advertising. That's the second biggest and a big deal. The third is that they get specific support to say what they're going to say by people who have a vested interest in their saying it. And the fourth, and sadly this probably doesn't apply so well to public media, although I would argue perhaps a little, is they take investors' dollars with some promise of a future business model, spend them, and go out of business. Those are the only four models I've seen. My perception is that in the future there may be a way to monetize users and viewers. To date, I haven't seen anybody prove that very well. I think that figuring out how public media can engage on piggybacking those four proven ways of providing support in this space is really important in the short term. And then lastly, and I know I'm running long, but 15 seconds. Business models are about how you support yourself over a long period of time. It takes a while to get from here to there. There's a really important role to be played in funding organizations that move from point of concept and proof of concept to being able to execute on their business model at scale. I would love to see people who are changing the public media space be able to have lucid conversations about where they are on that trajectory the way that, that dot-coms did for a while when you figured out whether they were flaming out or going somewhere transformational, and being able to talk about how to capitalize that risk and separating that from ongoing support. There's a story that says investing and giving rise to organizations is important, and another that says organizations supporting themselves is really important. I think that's a place our dialogue needs to go. Thank you.
You're here. Okay. Thank you. Okay, Vince?
All right. So if this is mapping the money, I kind of was thinking it might be like a pirate movie or something. You know, X marks the spot. Somebody's got the parchment paper here. I'm not sure with the X, and I'm not going to do a Johnny Depp impersonation. But, you know, it might be Pirates of the Caribbean 4, Curse of the Dying Demographic or something like that. I'm not sure exactly. But we're all in our own way trying to figure out how to transform our organizations in a time of great change, and that's true of commercial organizations as well as non-commercial broadcasters and media organizations. And while it's a continuing struggle for public media, non-commercial media, I think it's a total freak out for the commercial sector, right? I mean, for years they've been sort of at war with their audience. Maybe they've got a truce now. Maybe I think they have, actually. They've adjusted in some ways much more to their environment than non-commercial. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit. you know, a lot of people have talked about the Radiohead experience, the Radiohead experiment of within the last year. It's in your article. I think it's a really interesting one. Well, it's the notion that Radiohead would put its music out, allow its listeners to download it for free, pay what you will, pay something. You could pay zero. That would be your choice, or you could pay something. And apparently 40% chose to, well, I don't know.
Yeah, whatever.
That, yeah, whatever the figure was. Somebody said 40%, but I don't know. In any case, they experiment with that. I think we've heard that Nine Inch Nail has experimented with that. And it's regarded as a revolution in the commercial media industry, in the music industry, that you'd give it away and trust somebody. Well, it's called a business model. In public media, you know, that's what you've been doing. Public radio has been doing that for, I don't know, decades, you know, as long as it's existed, something like that. So we're familiar with that. And while, you know, we have the new SRG data just out, fresh off the press, that shows that for the first time in inflation-adjusted dollars, the take of individual donations is just off slightly, it's still $280 million a year, which is a substantial amount of money coming into on a complete honor system. You don't have to pay anything, but your audience does. So I think it's really important to see. You know, you could look at that data, and Tom Thomas is here from SRG, and say, you know, it's a glass half empty or a glass half full. But if you're at Universal or Warner Music, you don't know if there's anything in that glass at all. And, you know, it's in some ways more challenging to the commercial sector. And yet I think in some ways they've adapted more dramatically than public media. We have the examples of Radiohead, for example, but you know, more than that, just all the media, the recording companies are putting their content out. I mean, if you go to MySpace, you could pretty much hear whatever you want. You could hear streaming copies of songs, full songs, you know, most of the album of an artist. You could hear a lot of stuff for free. How different is that from 5 or 6 years ago when they were suing Napster, they were suing, you know, the college student, they were suing the college student's mother who didn't even know her computer was being used for that purpose of downloading content. And I think there's been some change there in terms of their orientation against their audience. And so, you know, at the same time, just on this one example, one more thought is, a lot of people will say, great for Radiohead, but what if you're a breaking band or an individual, or if you're not one of the major market superstars, then how do you break in? And just another example from the commercial sector is, there's an artist, Colby Calais. 18 months ago, she was working in a tanning salon in Santa Monica or something like that. Now, I'm sure that's a good living. But now, after she had 10 million downloads of her music on MySpace, after she had 10 million downloads, then she got a recording contract with Universal. And then she sold 2 million records. And then now she's out on tour with John Mayer in one of the biggest tours this summer. And she really broke through in 18 months. But it's a completely different entry point to the marketplace. And equally different is just the general notion of how you sell music in that industry. It used to be an artist would record an album, go out on tour to promote the record, to sell the record. Now you sell the record as a promotion. You put the record out as a promotion for your tour where you really make the money. So all of that is to say, what are we doing in public media to how dramatically are we willing to attack our own business models and say, is that really the right relationship? So just one thought along these lines, and then maybe hopefully we'll open it up for dialogue afterwards too. But the subscription model for public radio listeners, for public television listeners, you know, we're hoping to get $50 a year, $100 a year, you know, $120, $10 a month, $120 a year. That is pretty rigid. And where is the iTunes 99 cent per experience price point for public media. How do we give them, if anybody's listening to those podcasts, Jake, do we give them an opportunity to click 99 cents somewhere? Is there a PayPal click? Is there some micropayment? And I think we really need to adjust, certainly, as we're hoping to bring in new audiences with new formats, etc., we better give them a pricing model that makes sense to them. Because we just say, wasn't that a great song? Wouldn't it be great if you gave us $120? They would say, "What are you smoking? You know, they're not going to respond to that. So just my final thought on that is, a lot of people have said, we've tried asking people for money online. It doesn't work. Well, it's early. It's very early, and if you look at just the way things have changed in, say, 4 years, from 2004 to 2008, in the electoral system, Howard Dean broke through, just scratched the surface, and now the Obama campaign, with its $1.5 million donors, over $100 million in giving. Equally, in the charitable sector, there's a group called Network for Good. In 2004, they took in $17 million in donations. In 2007, they took in $53 million. So if you are assiduous in going for it, you can actually get returns through that medium. Thank you.
Thank you. And as a point of information, the Berkman Center, I'm sure some of you know, is doing work in this area, the VRM project, with the REL button and voluntarily donate support. And we do have a few public media shows on iTunes. For starters. Okay, Dean Wilson, please.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. I want to congratulate, I think, is this the third Beyond Broadcasting?
Mm-hmm.
One in Boston,
yes.
One down here. This is a great meeting, and it's essential, and there should be 50 more meetings like this. And I'm afraid if we don't have 50 more meetings like this, we're in serious trouble for the following reason. So I want to inject a note of political pessimism and urgency into the discussion. It's based on the following syllogism. Democracy rests on a free and independent and transparent press, media. Two, media is going through enormous turmoil on the print side, on the broadcasting side, etc. Ergo, we may be seeing democracy at risk. Now, I'm not saying it's an automatic syllogism, but what I want to do is, as we think about business models, reintroduce the notion of why we ultimately care about this, because it does have something to do with representation and openness and freedom and democracy. And my fear is that if those of you in this room don't get this right pretty soon, the quality of democracy in the United States of America is going to start to decline and stagnate, and it will be our fault. Strong letter to follow. Let me suggest why I think that's the case. Let me put on my Corporation for Public Broadcasting hat. So I'm the longest serving member on CPB. I'm not speaking on behalf of CPB in my personal capacity, but we are seeing loss in market share on the television side. We're seeing stagnation on the radio side. The stuff that we do is fabulous for the groups that we do it for, but we are frankly way behind the curve in adjusting in public service media to what is taking place on new digital platforms. It's enormously frustrating. It's ridiculous. Public service media was designed to serve the underserved, to create a public sphere, to create dialogue and discussion. To me, this sounds like the features of digital media. It's interactive, it's online communities. The fact of the matter is, especially at our beloved local stations, which are among the last local voices in any of our communities around the United States of America, by the way, with Clear Channel, et cetera, they simply are not doing that. The national organizations are trying, God bless them, to move this forward. But if we continue at the same slow pace, we will have less public service media, and we will have a poorer democracy as a consequence. So therefore, as we think about business models, which are hugely important, and I spend much of my deanly life, putting on my dean hat, going around raising money, talking to people at Fox and NBC Universal, et cetera, et cetera. And as other people on the panel have said, they don't have a clue. But they sure are working faster than we are in public service media to try to figure this out. They're throwing stuff on the wall to see what sticks. We aren't doing that with the same alacrity, but what we are doing is much more important because it will support a non-commercial public space that we want our children and our grandchildren to watch, untainted by commercialism. So this is a really big deal. Let me just give you an example of the way public broadcasting has been funded. For more than 300 stations, we get something in the order of $450 million. That's chump change. That is absolutely chump change when you consider the quality of the work that's being done in your local communities and by the national producers. But it's ridiculous. Thank goodness the foundation, some of the private foundations represented in this room, have also been supportive of initiatives, of trying to support innovation. The local stations do their pledge drives, and you end up with a mug or a glass of water or something like that. That certainly isn't bringing home the bacon. So we are in real trouble, and it's not going to be solved. This trouble is not going to be solved only within the public broadcasting system, for the same reason that the newspaper, fixing the newspaper is not going to get fixed by the people in the there in the newspaper, because they're absolutely shell-shocked. They're not hiring people. They're letting between 1,500 and 2,000 employees go per year. So what do we have to do to fix this? And I mean all of us in the room. Well, I have a mapping graphic here, slightly old school. Can you all see that? These are four vertical things that we could call silos. Okay, there are four silos. We've got a print silo over here. We've got a Freudian slip. A digital media discourse in the middle. We've got a public broadcasting discourse taking place over here in the corner that people don't pay too much attention to. And we've got a commercial discourse about democracy that is completely non-existent, because the FCC has said if you're a commercial medium, you really don't have to pay too much attention to multiple voices or free access, etc. So we've got these four silos that could be addressing democracy. If we remain siloed, we will not be able to solve the problem of public service media. Each of the silos has something to bring. The print discourse people have a passionate commitment to democracy and media. They really think it's important for some odd reason. And they're brokenhearted that their medium is broken. The digital media folks, many of us in the room, look at interactivity and online communities and user-generated content, and we see the potential of that. The public broadcasting folks I've talked about already, that's in our DNA. The commercial people, I don't think they really pay attention to this. What we have got to do is find a way to enhance our communication and in mutual engagement across the four silos. Because none of you in the room operating in any one of these single silos, with all due respect, has the political clout nor the imagination to do it by yourself. If we rely only on the silos operating, we will not come up with inventive business models. We will not redefine the audience. So, for example, in public television, which is now between 1 and 7, then we write them off until they're 47. And then we have programming for them until soon after they die, when we stop our programming. There is very few media voices, minority voices, in between 8 and 46. So what should we do? Well, number one, we need to realize that this is a political issue. I really strongly disagree with the last panelists who said, oh, we don't need an agenda. We'll just sort of do things, and in a sort of libertarian way, it'll all work out. That may be true for you, but I can assure you the National Association of Broadcasters has an agenda. I can assure you that the Motion Pictures Association of America, they have an agenda. And if you don't have an agenda, you'll probably lose. So in conclusion, let me just suggest that we need more of these kinds of conversations. They need to be more proactive. They need to be programmatic. What are the four issues we need to address? The foundations need to get themselves better organized. And those of us who receive public funds or who would receive public funds need to continue these kinds of conversations, but at a much more detailed and politically sophisticated level. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to our panelists. Okay. Now, I'm going to go through the Twitter questions, and then we're going to take questions from the floor. But I'm challenging everybody in this room to come up with one good idea. One. You come up with more, great. But you've got to throw an idea on the table. I don't want to hear any more about we got problems. Let's solve them, okay? And here's my question to you all. How far should public media and or public broadcasting be willing to go in redefining what is not commercial enough in the new media space, in the interactive space, to use it, embrace it, and generate funds with it so that it can be financially self-sufficient? Hello? Okay, somebody on the panel. Yes.
If I can take that, or at least a shot at that.
I'd like everybody to give me one quick answer, if you could.
So I think the short answer is the decision of whether to embrace commercial practices isn't based on whether you're public media or not. It's whether your mission within the very broad public media sphere is compromised by embracing commercial practices. And if it is, absolutely steer clear. And if it's not and it helps you deliver on your mission, do it. Make an intelligent choice based on mission rather than on status or the affinity group of being in this room or whatever the other association might be.
I completely agree. And working with organizations and helping them build communities, sometimes they'll take risks that aren't necessarily commercial at all but flop because they're not aligned with their values and their principles and their audience. I'm not convinced that a commercial endeavor would flop in that way for some of these properties. So I would agree that it's not necessarily whether it's a commercial endeavor or not, assuming that we're not talking about compromise. I think it has a lot more to do with what are the values, what are the principles, and do we have the imagination and the guts to explore them?
I guess I'd just like to flip it and say, could we also explore at the same time the outer edge of non-commercial behavior at the same time? And that is, you know, Norwegian state television will just take its latest, greatest show and put it out over its air and also for immediate free download to anyone in the world. Why couldn't we try that with some of our programs? It doesn't seem like full download of any of our public broadcasting content is available. And why wouldn't we find something we could give away after having paid for it three times?
Okay. The public has already paid for a lot of the content that is you have paid for the content that's produced on NPR and PBS. Right. We have right now a lousy digital rights management system. It's completely unworkable. And until that is worked out, as many of you in the room know, we can't solve this. Secondly, let's focus on a younger demographic. And my hunch is that there are some business models that could emerge. We've heard about some of that, voluntary payment, whatever you will. That's likely. But the digital rights management piece is absolutely essential.
I'm going to open it up to the floor before we take a couple of Twitter questions, but I did want to reference this graphic, which Jessica and I worked on very hard to come up with our own map, and it's self-explanatory, but basically what I'm trying to do is put the business model somewhere between the consumer, because it's all consumer-centric, that's where the money is, and the things on the outside, the devices, the platforms, are just incidental. It's all the stuff in between that counts. You know, these things facilitated the affinity groups, the products, the services, and then these are where you're going to make your money and your connections. In my mind, it's all about connections, not commercials. Do we have any questions from the floor? Yes.
Question or suggestion. Is anybody studying these issues in other countries, especially in Europe, where there's a strong history of completely supporting documentaries and things like that. That's changing.
Mm-hmm. Quick response to that. The Social Science Research Council has a proposal to investigate this. My suggestion would be one of the things that we look at beyond broadcasting next year is the other 99% of the world that is trying to do this. The Scandinavian, Nordic countries are doing some very interesting things. The BBC is looking at this. We may have something to teach them, but I think developing countries, Europe, have also something to teach us. So that's an excellent question.
Another question.
My question is, I'm working on a feature-length documentary about black photographers, and it's a multimedia project. And one of the things I'm really interested in doing is starting to release the film in modules from now until the 2010 broadcast. And, you know, part of the having gotten a little bit of money from ITVS and from NBPC, the National Black Programming Consortium, you know, there's certain restrictions in the CPB contract that keep you from releasing, you know, small sections of the film. I mean, it's old, it's an archaic kind of model. But I'm interested in building an audience from now, in the 18 months preceding the broadcast, and not necessarily selling those, but really reaching out through a variety of different social networks to get people hooked on the subject and get involved. So the issue of contracts is a big one. It's one that's kept me from pursuing certain closing a deal with a certain funder because, you know, I don't want my hands to be tied in terms of this new models of distribution.
Yes. Oh, was there a question?
Yes.
Yes, that's... let's talk afterwards. Okay.
My question is primarily for Dr. Wilson. In your silo model... if you're concerned about democracy, what I noticed was that your model didn't include the people or people's organizations or the government. And I'm just wondering what I'd be really interested in your opinion on the opportunities for their role in that.
It's their country. this was in part in 4.5 minutes to try to convey the important notions that for those of us who are in the discourse about media and democracy, we are siloed. I know some of you were just in Minneapolis for the Free Press meeting. There were 3,500 activists from all over the United States, 3,500, up from 1,500 2 years before, who were desperately concerned about all of these issues. One of the things I think we have a bit of a problem with is that those of us what do the media stuff, especially new media, may not integrate as well with some of the political activists who are really pushing these things through NGOs and other organizations. So I think that is an issue that has got to be done. And also, at some point, we've got to get beyond talking to just those of us in the silos, because nobody cares about this stuff. They don't care. They care about jobs. They care about health care. They care about the environment. So we can talk about pixels and broadband. They want to know about jobs and health care. And that's another link that's got to be made, it seems to me.
Okay, this side of the room, please.
Professor Jenkins brought up Four-Eyed Monster, which is that the filmmakers that got a lot of attention by doing podcasts of their project. And what's interesting is that they ended up spending about $100,000 through all these podcasts and stuff. And their ways of raising money, a different website said if, you know, you click through and you join our website, we'll give them $1. You know, so they were making money that way. So sites that did know how to monetize these eyeballs were relating with sites that were pure media in a sort of strange conglomeration. And I was wondering if you guys have other examples of how that can work, sort of a strange relationship where the money comes from something totally different than watching the media in some ways.
Anybody?
Well, there's Cup of Rice. I mean, it's pretty much the same thing. People are familiar with that, where it's just an ingenious game, really, where many people are probably familiar with it. I don't know if you are, but you come to the site and you go through some spelling tests, and your destination page on each of your spelling questions, and I'm sorry, it's not spelling, it's word definition, rather, has a list of sponsors. And because the goal of the project is to provide a cup of rice, then the sponsors want to be aligned with that. They want to be visible in that guise, and it gets a significant amount of traffic and eyeballs. That's just another advertising example.
Okay. Next question. Thank you.
Just building on something Craig talked about, which is the four models, the last of which doesn't work, but the first two, ads and commerce, are ways that are monetizing strategies or business models that do work. I'm wondering, in the realm of public media, how our funders and how CPB, for instance, would feel about financing the part of our work that will generate a user base, which is the essential ingredient that Keith talked about. And then phase two is possible, where you can monetize and try to bring revenue in. And then, you know, maybe there are shared revenue models that make phase one legitimate.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Just a brief. Without any disrespect to program officers in the room who've ever written planning grants, actually the model number four that says you go and take some investment to try and get there, that's real, and that happens in our space as well. So I wouldn't want to dismiss that. And actually, more importantly, I would say the biggest difference between commercial and non-commercial media is that in commercial there exists money on the balance sheet to go and invest in things and put the best talent after it. And so in a very real way, I think the best thing we can do to solve that conundrum is to figure out ways to raise capital to place smart bets on putting the best talent on the hard problems without knowing the answer up front. But Vince, how
do you? Well, another way of addressing that is there's a lot of money in the system, and a lot of it is coming from foundations, maybe increasingly. Certainly just at an anecdotal level, taking from our own foundation, the CERDNA Foundation is putting a little more money into media and communications than it did before. It's not a lot, but, you know, we've supported a number of groups in the room. At the Regional Association of Grantmakers in New York, we're paying more attention to it as a group at the regional level, Grantmakers in Film and Electronic Media as well. In the most recent Council on Foundations gathering here in Washington about a month ago, there was a one-day-long media summit at the museum. And I think GFM was expecting 50, 60, maybe 80 participants, and they more than maxed out at 300. So I think there's a growing and significant interest in the funding communities. It's not just Ford and MacArthur and Knight, though they are the major players. It's also, I think, the Skoll Foundation is here. And they're taking a very interesting, much more hands-on approach to the question. So there is, I think, and in all of it, we're all aware that we can't carry it forward indefinitely. So we're looking for the sustainability model. If we can help you create through some sort of growth capital approach, what can you do to carry it forward with a sustainable model?
One last question, and it kind of is an aggregation of some of the Twitter questions and whatnot in the interest of time, and that is how concerned should we be, panelists, that public media and public broadcasting are quickly being marginalized by everything from in activist groups and individuals and network organizations that know how to use the interactive media, aren't afraid to try things very quickly, who will move more quickly than maybe stations or PBS or CPB are willing to move, by travel, history, discovery, the cable channels, who have the same mandate and are collecting not only subscriber fees but commercial money from cable operators who are already partnering with the likes of PBB Kids and Sprout, again, subscriber fee-based. The Hulu is an example of commercial media reaching out to the best of what public television is. iTunes is reaching out to the educational aspects of public media. So guess what? You know, the people who maybe don't get it but are trying or are getting it, collectively, this could quickly marginalize what all of you stand for. How concerned should we be about that, and how quickly do we move to do what in response? Last question.
You should be afraid, very, very afraid. Because, you know, what do you want your kids to watch? You know, do you want them to watch real educational commercial or real educational television, or do you want them to watch, you know, Cheerio commercials? It's a very serious problem. I do think, I don't want to end on a negative note. We had a meeting of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a number of you in the room, Tom was in the room, others, where we met with the folks from Apple and EA to try to learn. So I think there is a new sense of willingness in the system at the local level. Someone once said, I think it was Samuel Johnson, nothing so wonderfully concentrates the mind as the prospect of being hanged in the morning. So there are a lot of conversations taking place between radio and television, old media, new media, foundations and recipients, and I would simply urge all of those conversations to continue. CPB is very much involved in that, and I would just, that all of us have to do more of that and really stick to it.
Okay.
I have a quick reaction to that, too, and that is, of course, you have to work with whatever robust channel you can to get your content out there. So if you've got an opportunity to work with iTunes or Hulu or whatever, you've got to explore that within the bounds of taste and commercialism and whatever your boundaries are as far as that's concerned. But at the same time, I think everyone in this room has an obligation to help build the infrastructure of each other. And that is, you're never going to bump up on those Alexa ratings. None of you will bump up on your Alexa ratings unless you start building each other into stronger channels. And if every time, I'll just give an example that I'm most familiar with. We support an online video service called Miro, which is free. It's open source. It's all the good things that you'd want in here. It just doesn't have any money. Well, of course it doesn't. That is the big challenge for the sector, and that is the capitalization of robust channels. But at the same time, it works perfectly. It works today. It doesn't have the $80 million that Juiced has, its direct competitor, but if you open up the page, it also doesn't have Dancing with the Stars staring at you as the kind of content that Juiced will naturally feature for its commercial imperatives. So if you want to be on the big channel that will never feature you as the most prominent content, you can stay with the commercial partners exclusively. Otherwise, I think you've got to get some sense of an obligation to help build each other into stronger channels.
I want to thank our panelists for giving us some good food for thought. I want to thank each of you for staying here and helping us think through this. I want to wish you all the best of luck in your endeavors. Go out there and get them. The truth is out there. You know what you can do. Good luck.